spelled E-Z-E-R. It's pronounced Azer instead of Ezer, as you would think it is. It means to help. It means to succor. It means to provide help. It's used 16 times out of the 21 times in a direct reference to God as being our helper. There's a similar word that appears actually 77 times and translated helper, helper, and it's Azer, A-Z-A-R. And I believe that's more like a general help. You know, we help each other and help comes, you know, the cavalry comes and this type of thing, rather than a very strong, powerful type of help that Azer is referring to. It's more of a militaristic term, which has the basic meaning of great help or mighty help or powerful help. Strong's number 5828 says it's aid or help, to surround, to protect, and aid, to help, to succor. The primary idea lies in girding or surrounding, hence defending. Azer is a military term that's used especially in referring to times of war. Let's notice just three real quick passages here. First one is Exodus, the 18th chapter and verse 4. Exodus 18 and verse 4 says, and the name of the other was Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help, or Azer, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. So here Pharaoh was out to get him and going to kill him, and like in warfare, and so God intervened and prevented it. In Deuteronomy, the 33rd chapter and verse 29, Deuteronomy 33 and verse 29, says, happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people served by the Lord, the shield of your help, which is, again, the term Azer, and the sword of your majesty. Your enemies shall submit to you, and you shall tread down their high places. So it's very much used as a military sense, to protect in a time of war, to surround, to provide protection and a shield and this type of thing. In Psalms, the 20th chapter in verse 1, says, may the Lord answer you in the day of trouble, and may the name of the God of Jacob defend you. May he send you help, or Azer, from the sanctuary, and strengthen you out of Zion. So perhaps we're beginning to see that it is God who is actually the source of our strength and the one that does surround us and protect us and so forth. This word Azer is a very, very powerful military term that refers to God as somebody that you can rely on, somebody that offers you protection, somebody you depend on, somebody that's stable, somebody that's steady, somebody that's always there as a rock for you to hide behind, for you to lean on, for you to sit and rest on, and so forth. Somebody that's powerful and backs you all the way 100%. He doesn't stand in condemnation, but God is there to support you. He's there to give you aid, to surround you, to take you in his arms, to help you and protect you. One that you can absolutely put your whole life, your faith, your trust into, and in his help and in his aid to guide you and direct you. It's used so much, actually, in referring to God, that modern translators actually want to change the translations from help to mighty help, or mighty helper, or strong help, or highest help, or helper. They feel that this is such a strong and powerful term that they are talking about changing the translations to the highest help, our highest helper, or mighty helper. Over and over, the scriptures point out that God truly is a mighty helper, that he is there on our side to surround us, as it were, to protect us, to guide us, and help us in any way that he possibly can, that that God truly is our mighty helper, that he is one who does protect us, that our trust, our faith, our confidence can be and should be in him, that he is our shield, that he's our help, that he's, you know, that our faith, our trust, our belief should be, obviously, and have confidence in God that He will guide, that He will bless, that He will protect us, that He'll put His shield about us, that we truly can trust in Him as being our Azer. Powerful, powerful word. This term Azer, as you see, like I said, it refers 16 times directly to God as being the mighty helper and so forth. This is a type of term that I think we men can easily wrap our minds around when we think of somebody coming, you know, like the cavalry come charging in at the last split second and, you know, help us and save our life and so forth. Maybe women have more difficult time in dealing with military terms and so forth. But I think all of us certainly can get excited about God being our helper and God being the one who does provide the strength and the help for us, because this is a truly powerful term implying help in fighting back to back, so to speak, to ward off a common enemy, that you're not doing it alone, you know, God is there and He does help us. Azer is also used three other times saying that Israel trusted in a false help, that Israel put her stock, her trust, her confidence, her faith in other nations, which instead of providing true help, the help of God, the Azer of God, they had a false trust and a false help. Azer, his same word, appears in the Bible then two other times, 16 times referring directly to God, and to this extent, the other three times there refers to God, because it says, you know, these false help doesn't provide the help that God does. But the same word appears two other times in the Bible where it is actually applied to a human being. Now, when I found that out, I thought, well, probably it's applied to David, number one. You know, very powerful, strong man, certainly a helper of Israel, a man that dedicated his life to being a king and so forth. But I think it's interesting when we find out that it's not describing a warrior type, a powerful type of man at all like David. David actually comes in contact with what I believe is an Azer. Now, it's not labeled such because, like I said, these are the whole time, all of the places where this particular word occurs that I'm about to discuss, the last two, so it doesn't apply in this particular context. But I think when we do go through it, perhaps you will agree that truly this word, if it can be applied to a human, which it is, then this particular individual is truly a description of an Azer. I hope I have your interest peak, because truly, Azer is a mighty and powerful word. But let's look at the two times where Azer appears. Both of them are found in Genesis, the second chapter. First one is in Genesis 2 and verse 18, and then Genesis 2 verse 1. Genesis 2 and verse 18. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper." Not Azer, an Azer, comparable to him. King James Version says, "I will make him a meet," or Azer, "for him." Meet means to, as before him or with him, and so forth, to be with him. In Genesis 2 and verse 20, it says, "So Adam gave names to all of the cattle, to the birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper, an Azer, comparable to him." I was shocked after studying the militaristic term, Azer, and found out how it applied to God all those many times, that the only other two times it appears in the entire scriptures, it refers to a woman. That God created Eve to be an Azer. I was or not, but I think it refers directly to God being the only true, mighty, powerful helper. Three times it mentioned Israel trusted in false helpers, trusted in other nations. So in reality, those are referring passages referring to God being the only true and mighty helper. And the only other two times where this word Azer appears in the scriptures, it refers to a woman as being her husband's helper, a powerful, a mighty helper. Let's notice the passage that I was referring to about David's encounter with who I felt could be described as an Azer. It's found in 1 Samuel, the 25th chapter. We find a man whose name was Fool. And he turns out to be a fool. He was an absolute idiot. And he had a beautiful, fantastic Azer, a wife named Abigail. 1 Samuel 25 and verse 2. Now there was a man in Moen whose business was in Carmel. And the man was very rich. If he was in Carmel, California, he was very rich because that property out there sells for a tremendous price tag. Just joking, of course. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, and the name of the man was Nabal, which means fool. And the name of his wife, Abigail, which means my father is joy. And she was a woman of good understanding, a brilliant, intelligent, highly sophisticated woman, and beautiful appearance, had the rare combination, like my wife, of beauty and brains both. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. Caleb means dog. So he came from a long line of scoundrels. He was a sorry, good-for-nothing, worthless individual, and he had this absolute gem of a wife, an Azer. And so we find in verse 4 through 11 that David sent 10 of his men to actually assist and protect the men that were with the sheep and so forth. And this was about the only way that when an army was traveling that they had to be able to get sustenance, to be able to obtain food or a little extra money or anything like that. They would provide protection to the various farms as they would go along. Sometimes they would help them work. They would shear the sheep or, you know, haul the hay or whatever was necessary. And thereby, people would help support the army because they were providing a service for them. So David sent 10 of his men to help with the sheep, to shear them and offer them protection, to kind of be a hedge around them and surround them and protect them. And so Nabal, we find in verse 12 through 13, lived up to his name of being an absolute idiot. He was a fool. And he sent the king's servants away empty-handed. And when they told David, David became livid. I mean, David got so mad and upset. You know, he had sent these men over there for some period of time, and he expected them to be fed and to be taken care of for the service that they provided to Nabal and to his servants. So David grabbed his sword and 400 of his soldiers, and off he went to kill everybody of the household of Nabal. And so we find then that in verse 14, Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. God didn't have a lick of sense. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them. And when we were in the fields, they were a wall both to us by night and by day. We didn't have to worry about predators. We didn't have to worry about animals. We didn't have to worry about people. We didn't have to worry about thieves coming in and so forth. They were like a wall to us, and all the time we were with them keeping the sheep. Now in verse 17, therefore, know and consider what you will do, for harm is determined against our master and against all of his household. In other words, now it became personal because they knew David would come back and kill the whole bunch of them, not just kill Nabal, but would wind up with all of them being dead. For he is such a scoundrel that nobody can speak to him. He won't listen. You know, he's just an idiot. And he won't listen to what anybody says. So Abigail made haste, and she loaded up 200 loaves of bread and a bunch of supplies on donkeys, and off she went. She sent her servants ahead and told them, I'll be right behind you. Let me just get these last few things. But she didn't say a word to her foolish husband, Nabal. In verse 20, so it was as she rode on the donkey that she went down under cover of the hill. And there was David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missing of all that belongs to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so, and more also, to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all those that belong to him by morning light." So David was mad. He had a right to be. This was common custom during the day, that when you were offered protection, you paid for it. You honored it. You gave them food. You helped them, you know, on their journey and so forth. So David got just absolutely livid and was furious. Now when Abigail saw David, she hastened to dismount from the donkey, and she fell on her face before David. She was a very humble woman, a very submissive and a very yielding individual, and bowed down to the ground. So we find a very strong, humble individual, powerful woman, a submissive woman, a woman filled with tremendous wisdom. In verse 24, so she fell at his feet and said, "On me, my Lord, on me, let this iniquity be." So she was willing to die for that idiot of a husband of hers. She was willing to put her life on the line and let her be killed to save his life and his neck. You talk about the heart of a lioness. You talk about the heart of a strong woman, that here she was, Abigail was willing to put her life on the line for that nonsense, sorry, good-for-nothing idiot that she was married to, the worthless, worthless husband. And she said, "And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant." In verse 25, "Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he." He's an idiot. He's a nut. He's a fool. "Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." Abigail knew he was an idiot. Abigail had lived with him for how long? We have no idea. But she knew him front and back and, you know, everything about him. That he was actually, literally, a fool. But it's interesting that it's not recorded anywhere where she ever told him that. She never apparently approached him, didn't have knockdown dragouts, didn't argue with him. She accepted it. She knew that he was an idiot, and she accepted that. Apparently, Abigail treated her husband with respect and had certainly certain love for her husband. She was willing to lay down her life and take the blame for what happened, even though she was not involved in it and didn't even know about it until the servants told her what happened, and yet she was willing to take the blame for it 100%. She definitely put his life, Nabal's life, above her own life and was willing to sacrifice herself for him to save his life. She was willing to fight for him, not fight against him. She then informs David that she was not involved in the incident with David's men, but that she felt like that she could spare David from bloodshed and bloodying his own hands. And then she gave the gifts to the young men and to David that he sent to Nabal. In verse 28, Abigail then asked David to forgive her trespass. Like, she took the responsibility, so she assumed the responsibility on herself. She then explained very tactfully to David that he really did not want to kill Nabal and all of the males there and all of his household, that it would be better if he just let God take care of it. So she used a lot of sense. She used a lot of wisdom. She used a lot of restraint. Then in verse 32, then David said to Abigail, "Blessed is the Lord, God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice," smart, intelligent woman, "and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with mine own hand. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hastened to come to meet me, surely by morning light no males would have been left to Nabal." So David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said unto her, Go in peace to your house, and see that I have heeded your voice and respected your person. Now, that's quite a statement coming from a king. They don't throw out that kind of statements to anybody. They're used to servants. They're used to slaves. They're used to being waited on hand and foot. And they don't throw out compliments like that. So this was quite a woman, very outstanding woman. In verse 36, we find that Abigail went to her husband and that he was very, very drunk, that he was putting on a feast like he was a king. And so she didn't say one word to him. She knew better than to go. She had enough sense and knew better than to argue with him when he was drinking and when he was sought drunk out of his head. So she waited. And in verse 37, so it was in the morning when the wine had gone from Nabal that his wife told him these things, that his heart died within him and he became like a stone. He was just petrified, apparently had a heart attack. And then it came down after about 10 days that the Lord struck Nabal and he died. So David didn't have to do it. She didn't do it. God took up the cause for David. So when David heard in verse 39 that Nabal was dead, he said, Blessed be the Lord who hath pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal. And he kept his servants from evil. For the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal to his own hand. He died 10 days later. I thought it was just kind of interesting. I don't know what kind of significance, if any, but David had sent 10 of his men to guard him. Don't know that it has anything to do with anything, but I thought it was interesting. So David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke unto her, saying, David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife. Then she arose and bowed her face to the earth. Tremendous, humble woman, yet highly intelligent. And so, and said, Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. So she got down and apparently washed the feet of the individuals that David had sent to her, again showing tremendous humility, because here she was about to become a queen. So Abigail rose in haste. Apparently she was excited about being married to David, and I guess so. After being married to such a fool, she was excited. And she rode on a donkey, and attended by five of her maidens, she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. So Abigail was truly a fighter. She was willing to put her life on the line. She was willing to take the blame. She was willing to die for her worthless, sorry, good-for-nothing husband. And some of you women might be saying, been there and done that. I don't know. But, you know, she did. She fought with her brilliance. She fought with her intelligence. She fought with her life, literally. But she didn't fight against her husband. She fought with wisdom. She fought with understanding. She fought with humility. She fought with submission. She was a lady in every sense of the term. A lady of strength, of courage, of power, of tenacity. A lady who was very sophisticated. A woman who was sharp and generous. A woman who was absolutely gorgeous, beautiful, as the Bible says. She was a sharp woman, and she fought hard for her husband and for her family and for her loved ones and servants. David had never faced an enemy as sharp as Abigail. She wrapped him around her little finger, all through the humility and subservitude of the attitude that she had. She was a warrior at heart, but she picked her battles. She knew which battles to fight. And her battle was not with her husband. She fought for him, even though he was an idiot, even though he was a dog of a man, and even though he endangered her life and the life of all of their slaves and servants and friends, she didn't fight against him. She fought for him. Abigail had an inner strength. She had a tremendous power. There was just something in that woman that truly, I believe, she was an Azer, that she was a mighty helper. She knew how to handle a fool, and she knew how to handle a king. She made quite an impression on David, so much so that as soon as her husband died, then David asked her to be his wife right away. Proverbs 31. Betty was telling me that when she was a girl going to church in St. Louis, that they had a Bible study on Proverbs 31. And in preparation for the Bible study, all the teenagers, the young girls, were required to memorize Proverbs 31, verses 10 through 31. And she said that that memorization and going through it just point by point, so forth, through the Bible study, made really quite an impression on her as a teenager, and it really helped her to want to be like this Proverbs 31 woman when she would grow up and get married and have a family. Betty pictured this Proverbs 31 woman as a great role model. She, and I think that's great advice for our young women today, and for that matter, for our older women, you know, to be truly like a Proverbs 31 woman. This is a very powerful woman that's discussed here, a woman that you can emulate, a woman that you can certainly pattern your life after, because this is a powerful, powerful woman described here in Proverbs 31. Certainly Brittany, Lindsay, and Paris should not be anybody's role model. I mean, that's just pathetic. But this woman we read about here is willing to fight for her family, not fight against her family, not fight with her family, but fight for them. She surrounds them with blessings. She embraces them with security. She enfolds them with love. She's quite a woman who is a tower of quiet power and strength and patience. You'd do well to pattern your life after this woman here, this very powerful woman. I'm going to just read it very quickly. We're not going to explain anything. You can do that later. Go back and study it. But in Proverbs 31 and verse 10, who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The hearts of her husband safely trust in her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good, not evil, all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her handmaidens or her maidservants. She considers a field and she buys it. And from her profit she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength. She strengthens her arm. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hand to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She works hard. She extends her hand to the poor. She's very giving and loving and caring. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She's not afraid of snow for her household, for all of her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestries for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates. He's not a fool. He's not an idiot. Her husband's known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen and garments and sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household. She does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he eats, and does not eat the, let's see, I've skipped something. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm and deceit and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own work praise her in the gate. Now, I think all of us would admit that is quite a woman. This woman is a go-getter, a hard worker. She's a fighter. That sounds like a well-oiled military machine to me. That's organized, she's alert, she's powerful, she's dynamic, she's capable, she's protective, and productive. The Hebrew word, of course, Azer, doesn't appear here. We've discussed all the places where it does appear. And yet I think this is the description of an Azer, a woman, a military term, a woman who truly is a helper. She helps her husband. She doesn't fight against him. She fights for him and with him. Some of the ladies might be fighters, all right, but I think they've got the wrong enemy. They're fighting against the wrong individual rather than fighting for their husband. They're fighting against their husband. And every day that we do that, we nail another nail in the coffin of our marriage. Too many women, honestly, are too busy. You know, you've met them. Maybe you are one. I don't know. But too many women are too busy being critical to their husband, so busy judging their husband, so busy condemning their husband, so busy trying to change their husband, so busy fighting their husband that they cannot find a way to fight for them, but rather they fight against them rather than fighting back to back with them, to surround them, to protect them, to aid them, to embrace them, to be a mighty helper for them. Same with some of the teenagers. Sometimes they never get any praise. It's just always no. It's just always a fuss. It's just always a fight, rather than, you know, providing the shelter and the love and so forth. Satan is out to destroy our families. There's no question about it. Satan hates God's way, and God's way is family. The building block of any nation is the family. A nation is no better than the families that comprise it. Satan hates families. Satan is out to destroy every family in this nation and every family on the face of the earth. And sometimes not only do we allow it, we embrace it and we encourage it, and sometimes we are the greatest tool that Satan uses to destroy our very own families. Your husband and your family are bombarded every day by Satan. Every day they fall under temptation. Every day they fall under Satan's sway and influence if we don't protect them and watch about what happens. Satan would love to destroy your mate. He would love to destroy your family. He would love to destroy you. You, as an Azer, need to wrap your arms around them, to enfold them, to protect them, to help them, to succor them, to aid them, to be everything that you possibly can be to support them and comfort them, to fight for them, to fight with them, not to fight against them. They're not your enemy. Your husband, your children are not your enemy. Satan and sin are the enemy. So please take whatever steps it's necessary to be able to prevent and thwart Satan's influence away from your husband and away from your children. Every day your family is tempted. Every day your family is tried and tested. And it seems, I don't know, it's just gotten to be ridiculous. You can't even see an ad on television for Firestone tires without some skimpily clad gal in a bikini advertising these tires. And what that has to do with tires, I have no earthly idea, but it sells tires. But those type of things, the things that we watch on television, have an influence on you, on your husband, on your children. It also seduces their hearts and the minds of your families. Daughters think they absolutely have no right because they're not just skin and bone, or perhaps because they cannot afford to go out and buy the latest fashions like so-and-so at school does, and so they feel like they're absolutely worthless as a human being, that they're not worth the salt that went on the roast at dinner, and they just feel like they're totally, completely worthless as a human being because they might be 5 pounds overweight or 100 pounds overweight. And so their self-worth is down the tube, and they need an Azer. They need a helper. They need someone to surround them and to enfold them and to help them. Do you blame or do you take countermeasures? Many women have tremendous difficulty in forgiving. I think us men have so many problems that perhaps it makes us a little more tolerant, a little more forgiving, so where overall I found, and I think most women admit this, that they have a tremendous difficulty in forgiving their husband's shortcomings, their husband's mistakes, their husband's infidelity, you know, that they have a hard time doing that. Do you condemn? Do you preach? And thus, do you take the steps necessary to protect and preserve your husband's love, your husband's love and respect? So there's not time or place to be too graphic in some areas, but I think, you know, are you the best wife that you can possibly be? Are you the best mother that you can possibly be? Sometimes ladies get their militaristic side up and going and up, and they wind up being directly working directly for by being against their mates or their family instead of constructively being a security blanket that enfolds them, that surrounds them, that protects them with love and protection, that it engulfs them with strength and honor. We read about Esther, who also, I think, was an Azer, because she was willing to put her life on the line. She was willing to fight for her nationality of being a Jewess. She saved, as a result, an entire nation. She was beautiful, and yet she was humble. She was absolutely gorgeous, and yet her attitude was that of a servant. She was a fighter, and yet very submissive, and she was strong, and she was courageous. In Esther, the first chapter, we find that King Ahasuerus was the king of 127 provinces, so he has this huge, huge display of wealth for 180 days to show off his power and his wealth, and he capped it off with a gigantic seven-day feast. Can't even imagine after 180 days that, you know, then he has this just blowout. And on the seventh day of pretty heavy drinking and eating and so forth, he wanted to show off his trophy wife, Vashti. Vashti was a gorgeous woman and apparently drop-dead gorgeous. And so he gets, you know, a little liquored up here, and he decides that he's going to bring her in and kind of display her and put her on the meat market, so to speak, before all these princes and rulers and so forth that were there with him. Well, Vashti refused to become part of the meat market, and she said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go before these drunken slobs. And so all the king's advisors immediately got upset, and they said, man, this could be catastrophic. This could cause all the women, you know, this example would be brought before all of the women in the kingdom if we don't do something. So in Esther 1, in verse 16, Queen Vashti had not only wronged the king, they said, but also all of the princes and all of the people who are among all of the provinces of King Ahasuerus, for the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. And when they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, and she did not come. So this very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. And if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the law of the Persians and the Medes, which is a law that cannot be changed, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. And when the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all of his empire, for it is great, all wives then will honor their husbands, both great and small. Then we come to Esther 2. Then the king gets lonesome. He misses his wife. So the seven advisors all get together, and they say, I tell you what, why don't we choose the prettiest, the sexiest, the smartest, the best from all of the kingdom to be your wife and to be queen? So they narrowed down the list, and they chose the chosen went into seclusion and training for education for 12 months. They were trained how to be a queen. They were trained how to truly be a lady and so forth. It's quite a responsibility to be a wife. It's quite a responsibility to be a queen. So at the end of the year's participation or preparation, the king chose Esther to be the queen. And at this point, no one knew that she was a Jew. Mordecai was her uncle. So Uncle Mort was actually raising Esther. He had been the one that brought her up. Now the plot begins to thicken. Two of the king's advisors were hatching a plot to kill King Azarias. And so Uncle Mort found out about the plot, and he told it to Esther. So she told the king, and the king hung the two bad guys. Well, he forgot about Uncle Mordecai. And so then this man, Wicked Haman, shows up. And his buddies, he buddies up to the king, and he gets, you know, buddy-buddy with him and so forth, and he gets all kinds of promotions. And everybody bowed down and scraped before Haman. And he was just really carried away with his power and might that he had under King Azarias. Everybody except old good old Uncle Mort. He couldn't stand him. And he let him know that he couldn't stand him. And the feeling was mutual. It burned Haman up. So he made his mind up to have Mordecai killed and all of his people, all of the Jews, totally eradicated and destroyed. So in Esther 3 and verse 12, we find that Haman wrote a decree, and he signed it with the king's name, and he sealed it with the king's signet ring. In verse 13, and the letters were sent by couriers into all of the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all of the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of this document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. Then in Esther 4, we find that it was a time of tremendous and great mourning for the Jews. And Mordecai said in the city gate, mourning in sackcloth and ashes. It was against the law at that time for him to be dressed like that, but he did it anyway. Uncle Mort told Esther that she had better do something about this, but the way it was escalating, that even the queen would not be safe because she too was a Jew, and that eventually it was going to be brought out that she was a Jewess, and she would be killed. So in verse 10, Esther sent word to Uncle Mordecai that the law stated if anyone went before the king without being called, that they would be killed unless the king would hold out the golden scepter. And Esther said, I have not been called. So in verse 13, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do you think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews? For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And yet, who knows whether you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this? In other words, he said, you know, God may have put you there just for this very purpose. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, nights or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, fine, I perish. Very brave woman, a very powerful, strong woman. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So Esther was willing to put herself in front of the lion of death to protect her family and to protect her nation. Then in Esther 5, after fasting for 3 days, she donned her queenly garments and she went to see King Azarias. Perhaps one of the most tense moments in the history of mankind, because the entire Jewish nation's fate was resting in the hands of this woman. If she's not accepted before the king, she dies, as well as the entire Jewish nation perishes. not only did she have to be accepted, she had to come up also with a plan, a brilliant plan, that would reverse the fate of the Jews. So she throws a big banquet to honor the king and Haman. So Haman was floating on cloud nine. He thought, man, I've got it made. I'm in with the king. I'm the number two man here. Life couldn't be better if it weren't for that old man out there, that Mordecai, that just absolutely is a thorn in my side, and I can't stand him. Well, Haman's wife and his, quote, friends get together, and they just say, why don't you get this thing over with? Just build some gallows and hang the sorry guy. And so they did. And then in Esther 6, King Azarias had a bad case of heartburn. He couldn't sleep. So he thought some reading might make him sleepy. So they brought him the book of the records of the Chronicles, which were read to him. You see, that's the difference between being a king and being like you and I are. When we can't sleep, we get up and read. When a king can't sleep, he gets up and somebody reads to him. But anyway, they read this to him, and I guess they hadn't learned about listening to sermons back at that point, so as being the greatest sleep aid you can get. So anyway, they read this book of the records of the Chronicles. Now, you talk about boring. I could see where that would put somebody to sleep. Even the title of it kind of sounds like that. His memory was jarred when he read about how Mordecai had brought to the attention about the two assassins that were going to slay him. And he thought and he remembered, hey, I never did anything for Mordecai. I never did honor him, and here he saved my life, you know, and put down a coup. And I never did really do anything for Mordecai. It dawned on him that he had never rewarded him. So the next day at the banquet, he asked Haman what he would suggest to honor somebody. You know, if you had to honor somebody, what would you do? And of course, Haman immediately with his vanity thought, oh, he's going to honor me. So he came up with this brilliant plan of, you know, put him on your horse and put your garments on him and all this and that and parade him through town and so forth. So his vanity reared its ugly head, and Haman concluded that the king wanted to honor him. So, man, he piled it on thick. And Haman was crushed when the king had him do everything that he had requested to Mordecai instead of to himself. So in Esther 7, on the second day of the banquet, Esther reveals that there's a plot to kill her as the queen and to kill all of her people. In Esther 7 and verse 5, so King Azarias answered and said unto Queen Esther, well, who is he? Where is he? Who would dare presume this in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went to the palace garden. He had to get out and clear his head. I mean, he had to think about this. What in the world was going on behind his back that he didn't know about? And Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And when the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Bad move. Then the king said, will you also assault the queen while I am here in the house? As the words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And now Habaron, one of the eunuchs, said unto the king, look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman has made for Mordecai, who spoke good to the king on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. And the king said, hang him on it. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's wrath was subdued. Then in Esther 8, we find on the day that King Azarias then gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, and Esther told him how he was related to him and so forth. So the king, in verse 2, took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king and fell at his feet. Very humble woman, very tender woman, very submissive woman, fell down at his feet and implored him with tears to counteract the evil that Haman, the Agagite, had this, in the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. So in verse 6, "For how can I endure to see the evil which will come to my people," Esther said, "or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen?" And since the king's law was the law of the Medes and the Persians, which could not be changed, even the king did not have the power to change a law once he put it into effect and once his ring stamp was put upon it. He did not have the power to go back and say, "Look, folks, I made a mistake." So they had to come up with another plan since they couldn't reverse that one. And they came up with a plan. He told them, he said, "Well, you write anything you want. You take my signet ring and you send it out." So they came up with a plan and told all the Jews to band together and to stand and to fight against anybody who would come to destroy them. And this scared the other people, and so they left them alone. And so Esther was able to save the entire nation. And it says, "By these letters the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together," in verse 11, "to protect their lives and destroy, kill, and annihilate all of the forces of the people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions." So Esther was a fighter, an ultra-feminine, beautiful, emotional, caring, submissive, highly intelligent young woman, sophisticated, educated, passionate about everything that she put her hand to. God used her to save an entire nation. Can God use you as a woman to save your husband, to save your children? One final example I want to use is outside of the Bible. Going back in the Middle Ages in Germany in 1141, the wives of Weisenberg, or Weisenberg, the Germans would pronounce, they pronounce a W as V. The Duke of Bavaria was besieged inside his castle of Weisenberg by the army of Frederick and his brother, the Emperor Conrad. Wolf was not going to surrender. He made his mind up, you know, "We're going to stand, we're going to fight till the end, to the death," and so forth. But Conrad was indignant, he was mad, he was upset that they didn't just give in, that he now had an extended siege on his hands. And so he sent word to the inhabitants, and he said, "Unless you surrender at once, I shall demolish your city, burn your buildings, and put all of the inhabitants to the sword." So he gave them an ultimatum. To this, the inhabitants returned a defiant challenge. They said, "We're not going to give up." And so the siege continued for some time until at last Weisenberg realized that they could not make it, that they were compelled to go ahead and surrender and to yield. Emperor Conrad was now more determined than ever because of the length of and the expense and so forth and the loss of lives that he had, that his original threat now was going to be carried out. And he ordered all of the men to be gathered together that they might be put to the sword and put to death. And so he told his men to prepare to be able to go in and to destroy the city, to burn it, and to kill everybody that was there. And so when this message got back into the city, of course, everybody was fearful and filled with terror and despair, and there was crying and so forth. They chose a group of ambassadors to go to Conrad's camp, and they said, "We men of Weisenberg are not afraid of your threat, and we're willing to submit to the fate of war." In other words, we're willing to die. You can kill us. You may burn our buildings, and you can destroy our town if you will, but we beg of you to spare our women. So Conrad replied, "I have sworn an oath that your city shall be destroyed, and your people shall be put to death. But it is not for me to wait to make war against helpless women. Therefore I shall spare their lives. Furthermore, you may tell them that on the morrow each of them may carry away on their shoulders whatever precious possessions that she may deem worthy of preservation. I do not wish to leave them destitute upon the world. So when the Duchess of Weissenberg heard this, she called all the women together, and in the marketplace, right in the center, she told the men to get out of there, that she had something to discuss, and sent them to another part of the city. And so she reached over and she whispered in the woman's ear next to her. And that woman reached and whispered into the ear of that woman, and then so forth right down the line, until all of the women stood there and they grinned from ear to ear. And they thought, and they understood, and they knew what was in the Duchess's mind. And then each of them smiled and walked away. The next morning, the gates were open, and Emperor Conrad, with his huge army, stood outside to watch the women file by, each one with her, quote, precious possessions. First came the Duchess, and to the astonishment of the Emperor Conrad, and to the admiration of the entire army, the Duchess was bearing on her shoulders her husband. All of the women behind her were burdened down with their loved ones, primarily their husbands, or some relative, as they came staggering out of the city gate with their husbands on their back. As the Duchess passed the emperor, she said, "We have your word, my lord, that we may bear safely away that which we consider to be the most precious, and each of us has taken her soldier husband. You are welcome to what is left in the city." The emperor's chagrin was quickly changed to that of admiration. The earnest faces of the women that were turned to him so appealingly at last changed his intention toward them and toward the city, and his heart relented. Turning to the women who were struggling along with their husbands on their back, he said to them, "You may rid yourself of your heavy but precious freight. I shall harm none of you, for you deserve to keep the treasure that you have borne." Then he called all of the men and the women to him, and he told them that he not only spared them, but also the whole city from its doom of sword and fire. Thus did the women of Weissenberg save their husbands and their town. The castle mount became known as the Hill of Vibertro, which means woman's fidelity. Mark H. Creech made a statement, said, "There's never been a time in the history of our nation where there was such a greater need for women like the wives of Weissenberg. Some might accuse me of fanciful language and exaggeration, but I say that America's fate rests squarely on the backs of its wives and mothers. Once more, we need the wives of Weissenberg to rise up and to show that few positions in this life are more demanding as that of a wife and of a mother. She sacrifices to make her home attractive, to do the laundry, to cook the food, to care for the children, and to care for her husband's personal needs. Nevertheless, her sacrifices give her life a depth and dignity that cannot be had in any other way. Moreover, the very fate of a nation rests upon her shoulders, upon how well she performs her unique, incomparable role in life. She is, in many respects, the hope of the nation." There's a quote from a very famous play that says, "The wife and mother in her office holds the key to the soul, and she stamps the coin of character that makes the being who would be a savage but for her gentle cares, a Christian man or woman, then crown her the queen of the world." I hope this sermon's given each and every one of you, especially the wives and mothers, a lot of food for thought, because this word Azer is a powerful, powerful, strong, mighty word, which means mighty helper. And truly, that's what you have been called to be. That your life and the life of your family is to fulfill this very reason of why you were created as a physical human being, is to be an Azer, a helpmeet. Actually, you ladies are now living the very role as an example of what life, of what all of us, men and women, are going to be in the kingdom of God, because we'll be doing for all eternity, we will live as the bride of Jesus Christ. Ladies, I stand in awe of you.